Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
Today on Maine Calling, our national story, what beliefs do we all share? Now more than ever, it's easy to talk about the differences in how people view our nation, what we want for its future, and what we view as important. The challenge, it seems, is finding values most of us share. Are there any? If so, can we build upon them for a brighter future? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, in a year-long project, the Nationhood Lab set out to determine whether Americans can find consensus and a shared purpose. The results of its survey and interviews are fascinating. Turns out the profound link for people on different sides of the political aisle, the Declaration of Independence. What does this mean for the American experiment? Maine Calling is just ahead. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In these hyper-partisan times, it often seems there is little we Americans agree upon. But a report released last month from the Nationhood Lab begs to differ. It found that Americans do hold certain important civic ideals in common. What are they, and why does this matter? Today, our guest is the director of the Nationhood Lab, a name you know. Colin Woodard is a best-selling historian and award-winning journalist. Also with us today, Washington Post columnist and senior advisor to the New America think tank, Theodore Ted Johnson. Share your comments and questions. Do you think that there are universal values in America? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Colin, so much of the work that you've done and so many of the conversations we've had on Maine Calling and other places are about the differences in Americans, the differences in the regions. Why did you turn that on its head? Why did you decide to look for the shared values?
Yeah, as many of your listeners may know, I do a lot of work on North American regionalism and the things that divide us. This book, American Nations, I think when it came out, I was your very first guest on the first episode of Maine Calling talking about it way back in 2011. But it was talking about how, you know, we're a balkanized federation, that the United States, its regional cultures were colonized separately. They didn't expect to be in the same country together. They had different ideologies and ethnographic and religious and political characteristics, and they ended up together in an accident of history. But the differences, the fundamental deep differences in outlook and the way societies were organized, have remained and have been our Achilles heel. So naturally, you know, being an American and not wanting the country to shatter, and at a time when the divides in our country and the risks of a dissolution are high, I, of course, have become very focused on how do you hold it together? And indeed, how have we held ourselves together in the past? And is there still a shared set of values, a shared story that, you know, red states and blue states agree on, you know, that people in Vermont and in Louisiana still share? You know, is there a, if you take the two overlapping circles of a Venn diagram, what's in between there for Republicans and Democrats, you know, rural voters and urban? In other words, is there still a common American story and an uber identity that most of us, despite our other divisions, still subscribe to? And if so, what is it? And how can we talk about it? Because we really need those guardrails of our shared experience today.
So you did a big survey. You followed up with lots of interviews. What did you find?
Yeah, big survey, lots of in-depth interviews, and then more surveys to perfect the language. And what was a really pleasant surprise going in is it turns out that Americans are already primed without, you know, perfecting your messaging around a shared set of values. And it's the ones in the opening to the Declaration of Independence, essentially that we as Americans are committed to and defined by our pursuit of trying to create a society where people can be meaningfully and sustainably free, you know, intergenerationally and for all. And that was a really revolutionary statement when it was first put out, but it's the one cohesive thing out there that crosses, you know, almost all the demographic segments and has an incredible degree of support. I mean, we were testing.
Yeah, go ahead.
In our opening poll, we were testing, okay, you know, do people really believe in the Declaration's values? So we had these competing sort of narrative statements like, hey, what do you think the purpose of the country is? You know, who belongs essentially was another pair of rival statements. You know, what does our past tell us? And in each one, we were keying one off the values in the Declaration, those propositions, you know, that people are have a natural right to survive and to not be tyrannized, to pursue their happiness as they understand it, to access the representative self-government that makes it all possible. You know, things, a statements keyed off that versus statements keyed off more heritage and intrinsic characteristics, you know, our character, our history, you know, things that you have to have been around and acquired as opposed to a universal proposition. And I thought that the latter would win. We tried to make them both as attractive as possible, if for no other reason than it felt really concrete. And some of those, you know, late 18th century ideals can seem so abstract and lofty, but no, it was the other way around. I mean, it was like 66-33 in favor of those Declaration civic values. And that held true when we went on to do in-depth interviews with respondents from the polls. You know, our pollsters do detailed conversations. We had these warm-up questions, you know, like, you know, what's America for? And then we were going to dive in after they warmed up into very specific questions about propositions in the Declaration. Do you believe this or not? But in the warm-up questions, like half the respondents, regardless of, you know, region, generation, education level, occupation, partisan orientation, just started in their own words, unprompted, basically quoting the propositions in the Declaration. So I was like, you know, I couldn't believe it, that that is hardwired back as Americans in the backs of our heads. So we perfected the language and then rolled out the report you described. But the encouraging thing is, yes, there is a story, and the data shows that a super majority of Americans agree with it, which is kind of amazing in this day and age.
Ted Johnson, our audience knows Colin well, not only because he's been on Maine Calling several times in his books, but also as a reporter for the Portland Press Herald. So I'm going to introduce you. You're on the board of New America. You're also a former Navy officer. You write a column for the Washington Post. And as a Black man, you're often talking about issues of race and identity and what it means to be an American. And so I'm wondering if you shared Colin's surprise at the results of the survey.
So I did. And a lot of it is because of polling done prior to Colin's survey, which showed that words like democracy didn't really resonate with Americans, especially when it came time to vote. It was all about the economy. How's my family doing? Do I feel like I'm better off today than I was 4 years ago? But when they were asked about the importance of democracy to their voting or their faith in democracy or their faith in government, very, very low polling or low priority. But it doesn't surprise me that when you ask Americans about sort of their core beliefs and what it means to be American, that they immediately run to the second paragraph of the Declaration. And that's where I consider the promise of America to be in that paragraph. And it says that we're created equal, that we have unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed, which is democracy in so many words. So it doesn't surprise me that people, Americans, believe in equality, they believe in rights, and they believe in democracy, but that doesn't necessarily govern their political behaviors or their electoral choices. So once we understand that distinction, then I think we can appreciate the fact that we're a values-driven country that doesn't always vote its values, but sometimes votes its socioeconomic interests over these sort of evergreen core values that are understood to permeate everything, but has the nation has fallen short in extending those values to everyone here.
Ted, I'm wondering, and if you feel as though the results of this survey also reflect your experience in the Navy, because since we are an all-volunteer military force, people are defending something when they sign up. And I know there are people on every part of the political spectrum who serve. And I'm wondering, as you read this survey, were you looking at it through that lens as well?
So just a little bit. And part of it is because you have two big groups of people who serve in the military and are all volunteer force. The first group is smaller than the second. The first group are those folks that join out of a sense of patriotic duty to country, or maybe it's the family business. The grandfather served, the father served, and now it's my turn to do my duty to serve the country. And that's, those folks are there, but they pale in comparison in terms of numbers to the folks who join because of the military's benefits. There's a steady salary pay scale. You don't have to negotiate salary. It's equal. It's fair. There's a understood and documented promotion system considered to be one of the most meritocratic systems in the country. Most folks are joining because of the VA home loans and GI Bill. So they get money for college, for either for themselves or for their children. They get help putting money, getting money together for a mortgage on a home without a lot of money down. So most folks are joining for sort of economic and social stability for themselves and their families, in addition to this notion to serve. But these sort of economic social interest governing people's choices to serve don't diminish the values that are represented in the uniform that they wear. People reenlist not because they want more of the money. You once you're in and a veteran, you have access to these benefit programs. They stay because of this commitment to service and because of the opportunity to see the world and do some other things. So it doesn't surprise me very much, the results from Colin's survey. It's pretty much aligned to both my life growing up in the South and Black, as well as my service in the military over a couple of decades.
All right. So now that we have these results, Colin, what do we do with them?
Right. Well, I totally agree with Ted that people don't always vote values first, that isn't what they're doing in their political behavior always. But in this day and age, figuring out how to talk about those values again, I think part of the problem is we stopped talking about what the purpose of the country was after we won the Cold War. It's like, hey, we defeated the enemy. We can now just, go worry about economic issues and globalization. And, the European Union is national boundaries are disappearing. Nationalism and talking about these things is for those, poor backward people in other parts of the world, like the Balkans that are fighting with each other. That was the vibe in the 90s. And by forgetting how to talk about this stuff, people were left with this sort of vacuum. And everywhere in the world, every country needs a story and every people needs a story that hold that what's essentially an artificial abstract group together around shared values. If you don't have that, then there's a vacuum that demagogues will wander into. So we need to know how to talk about this. So once we knew what the story was, the key was figuring out how you perfect the messaging to create a logical, inspiring core story about that answers those questions. Who are we as a people? What's it mean to be an American? Where did we come from? Where are we going? Those are the big questions in a national story. And so we did the follow-up polling to perfect that and came up with essentially a one-pager, what communications people call a core narrative frame, which sets out what that is. And if people are able to talk about it and think about those things, it will start crystallizing better people's understanding of what's at stake and, what you lose if you don't uphold these values.
Ted, a lot of people are very discouraged right now, and discouraged is probably not a strong enough word. A lot of people feel a sense of desperation. I understand that you feel optimistic about the future of our country. Explain that.
Yeah, maybe it's a character flaw, to be honest with you. It's not good to always be optimistic no matter what. But I am absolutely on the optimistic side of the scale, the spectrum. A lot of that is just looking at the story of my family and really the story of the country. I've I've said it a lot that I am much happier being a Black man in 2025 in America than in 1825 in America. Very, very different experiences. That is not, it was not an accident. It was not a gift to people. Lots of people died and bled and sweat and worked to change the country for the better. My optimism results from those folks. How can I possibly be discouraged about the country when 200 years ago, the people that helped create me were enslaved and still fought in the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War? I mean, they still were willing to die for the country's either for its independence or for its continued autonomy, even though they didn't get to enjoy all the aspects of our democracy or economy. So I draw my optimism from them. It's not blind optimism. I'm still a realist and a pragmatist. I understand we can't get to perfect tomorrow, but I get that optimism from them for sure.
All right. We are talking about sort of this whole idea that America has shared values. And when we come back, I want to ask you if you all believe that the shared values are stronger than the differences. But we do need to take a break. Please join the conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our subject today, do we as Americans agree on a sense of common purpose as a nation? With me today, Colin Woodard, director at the Nationhood Lab and New York Times bestselling historian. Also with us, Ted Johnson, a senior advisor at New America and a Washington Post columnist. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. So, Colin, the big question, does it matter more that we have this shared purpose? Is this shared purpose bigger than our differences, or have we passed that point?
I mean, it's essential to have this shared purpose if the country's going to survive, if the Republic's going to survive, or even the Federation. I mean, the stakes are very large. I'm have an optimistic stance, but it's tempered by, my background was being in Eastern Europe when communism collapsed, and then staying on my beginning of my journalism career was covering ethnic conflict, state building, collapses into fascism and the aftermath in the Bosnian War. So, when things go off the tracks, they can go way off the tracks. And having seen that show before, that tempers my, it focuses my attention on how important this is. So having a shared story is essential. And the values in the Declaration, they're really good ideals. I mean, they're the things that when Americans stop and say, what am I most proud about this country? It's almost always things where we were fulfilling or pushing ourselves closer to achieving those ideals. Ditto for people in the rest of the world looking at our country. When they're happy with the US rather than angry at us, it's almost always for exactly the same reasons. It's the basic pitch that Frederick Douglass was making in all of his speeches. It's Lincoln at Gettysburg. It's Martin Luther King at the Mall. I mean, it's a rousing and powerful and emotive story that carries a real impact. So we just need to use it and remember it again. And, be able to talk about it in a way that 21st century Americans understand. And because it's embraced, our polling and such that we did showed, it had support regardless of region, gender, education level, race. I mean, majorities supporting this in a way that you don't see on almost anything. And when we just asked the question, we decided at some point we should ask, there's a notion of a shared agreement, like a covenant, like that we as Americans are duty bound to protect one another's rights in the Declaration. Do Americans really think that? So we asked that question in one of our last polls. I thought it would come out, it's getting a little more optimistic, maybe 60-40 again or something like that. It was 97 to 2 in favor. It was the largest margin our pollsters had ever seen on the answer to any question. You never get that level of agreement. I mean, I looked up the polling for what percentage of Americans agree that the earth is round, not flat? It's 80-10 with the rest undecided. So, I mean, these are unbelievable figures. So we need to work with that because these aren't esoteric abstracts. They're the way we define ourselves becomes a metric for how we judge things, conduct ourselves, and how we can have all the legitimate political debates in our society about how to execute the American experiment, right? The American experiment in trying to make a society where individuals can be as free as possible over time. How do you do that? There's all kinds of questions about whether you emphasize individual liberty or the common good. But once we agree that the American experiment is our goal, that provides some very healthy guardrails and contours on the political conversation that currently have been lost.
Ted.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and listen to any politician, especially one running for president, they'll often say, we're the only nation founded on an idea, not on race or religion or a caste system, but on an idea. Now, the execution of the idea was extremely flawed at the beginning. I mean, pretty much had to be white, male, and Protestant to get, you know, to have a real shot at the American dream. But you know, it's that founding on an idea is critically important. And it's for that reason, as Colin said, that our shared vision is so important. Because if we disagree about what the idea of America is or what it should do, there's no other basis for connection. We can't go back 300 years and say, here is where our bond was forged across race and class and difference. Let's trust that bond to carry us through modern times. It's only the investment in the idea. And the other reason this is critical, and I think we're seeing some of this in our politics today, is because if you look at the highest, the points in our nation's history, let's say in the last 100 plus years, where patriotism has been the highest or national pride has been the highest, it's often at the entrance of war, at World War II, 9/11, the Cold War, as Colin mentioned. And so our identity, our national identity gets defined by who we are not. We are not the Soviets. We are not the Japanese or the Italians or the Germans. We're not, terrorists from the Middle East. And when you define yourself by who you are not, when you defeat the threat, you're left wondering, well, who are we now that there is nothing to sort of the counterweight? Where if we're a yin only defined by our opposition or oppositeness to yang, when yang goes away, we have nothing to rest our identity on. And so that idea becomes critically important to bring a nation as large as ours and as diverse as ours together and sort of fuel the continued growth of the country to become just a little bit more perfect.
We'll go to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guest. I, too, am an optimist, that is to say hopeful, but hope is not a plan. And the children of the Enlightenment, our founding fathers, who used the common people to throw off the king who was threatening their economic interest, created a structure for governance, which is contains the seeds of the Enlightenment and individualism, but it took the amendments to the Constitution in order to get that. Without the first 10 amendments, the Constitution is just a plan for sharing power. Throughout our history, we have had constant conflict between those who own the means of production, which at the beginning was slavery, and until now, when Trump ran, President Trump, he said, among other things, that he thought the Constitution was outdated, and we are learning that he meant that. In order to get back to the ideals of equality as God-given, we still need to have a practical means of controlling our thought processes. They've got them all now. They own the big media, and they own 90% of elections are won by the person with the most money. The hopeful thing is, in Wisconsin, Musk came
Torbert,
in
I'm
with
gonna let Colin
20 million
jump in
bucks,
now.
And
Colin,
it didn't
go
work.
Ahead.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that makes our situation high stakes and perilous is that while the Declaration was our founding statement as a people, you know, that was the opening statement as to who we are, we're leaving the British and this is what we stand for, it was contested almost immediately. The Constitution, the original Constitution, as the caller was implying, even with the 10 amendments, was betraying the Declaration in all sorts of ways, because it was a compromise document to try to hold these different regions together, including Southern oligarchic slaveholders who were dead set against the premise that humans were created equal. And in fact, all the way in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, there was a battle over how America was to be defined between this idea that we're defined by these ideals in the Declaration and another idea that was like, no, we're the ethnostate of the superior Anglo-Saxon race, or later it became white Protestants. But it was always one subset of people who are the master people to whom the country belongs, real Americans or whatever it is, and always other people who are citizens but are subjugated or lesser, right? The model was classical republicanism like ancient Greece and ancient Rome, where a small minority has the liberty or privilege to practice democracy and subjugation and slavery at the natural lot of the many. There was a whole philosophy behind it. It was a horrifying ideology, but it was absolutely, you know, having the contest throughout the antebellum period, the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, the Jim Crow era. It ran this country in the 1910s and 1920s when all these Confederate statues were tearing down, or were until recently tearing down, were being put up. When Birth of a Nation, a film celebrating the Ku Klux Klan's violent terrorist campaign to roll back the political emancipation of African Americans in the occupied South, was all the rage. People loved it. The federal government was being segregated. So what I'm saying is that the actual embrace, you know, required first three more amendments during Reconstruction that put the Declaration's promise into the Constitution finally, and then they were ignored for half a century. It wasn't until the 1960s that that civic promise became an accepted consensus creed across the Federation. And so yes, it's young. It's within living memory. It's not even that we've been a liberal democracy, small l, small b, since the 1860s. It's only been since the 1960s. So it is much more delicate than people realize. And that's why focusing on that good side is important, because there was always a dark side of the American soul that was trying to define it in entirely different terms, which has confounded the American experiment from the beginning. And people realizing that is essential to clarify what the stakes are, and that this is not merely abstract stuff. This is deadly serious and incredibly important.
Yeah, the founders, as Colin said, they were not lovers of democracy. They did not want the common man, and certainly not the common woman, to determine who should lead the country. But so what they, in the Federalist Papers, you know, they sort of make the case for why the state should ratify the Constitution. And they lay out this plan for checks and balances to make sure there's no king in government, or that one branch doesn't take power over the rest over the others or the rest of the country. But the whole thing hinges, I think it's in Federalist Paper 10, where it's written, I think this is Madison that writes, look, what it all boils down to is that the people who will represent us in government, they're going to be the best among us. They're going to be patriots. They're going to put the country before party. They're going to put the national interest before self-interest. And it's going to be because of the stalwart nature of our representatives that the system works. And so to me, the weak point in our democracy isn't the Constitution anymore. I mean, we've amended it, 26, 27 times or so. We have the process to do even more amendments if we want. What we lack now is one, a common story that we all buy into, and two, a system that helps us select the best people for the job and not the best resourced people for the job. And as a result, some of the character attributes that the founders relied on to make our system work just don't show up as much as we'd like to in the people that we have to vote for.
I want to ask you all, we keep talking about the Declaration of Independence and that's the sort of glue, the glue of the core values of America. And I'll go back to you, Ted. When we talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is there agreement about what that means?
I think Colin's research is helpful here. I think, yes, there's agreement that those things are important and they're core to America. But if you start asking people, what does life mean? Like when in the Declaration, what does that mean that the nation owes you, and what do you owe the nation? I don't think there's agreement. I mean, we're a nation that says unalienable rights include life, and we also have the death penalty. So the government can even take away the very life that they're saying is unalienable in its founding document. Liberty, that was in 1776 when those words were written. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1920. They couldn't run in marathons or get a credit card until the 1970s. So if we say this is a nation founded on the idea of liberty, we should be very specific in saying whose idea of liberty and at what point in the country's history is that definition sticky enough for it to align with us today and not for generations past. So yes, agreement on the words, in principle agreement, but in execution and action, complete disagreement and or not complete disagreement, but wide disagreement and a political system that incentivizes that disagreement out of political expedience to sort of help the parties win elections more than helping Americans come together.
And Colin, what about your research? What do you think about this idea that, yes, we have shared values and we think that we have this shared value, but is it really the same thing we're talking about?
Yeah, shared ideals. We did stress test some of these things. I mean, the real danger throughout our history and even today is, if you're saying that all people have these natural rights, then the weak point is go after who counts as people and who doesn't. That's always been the story throughout human history. You know, the people are only the subset. That's where that ethno-national authoritarian rival narrative of our story is. So there's that point. People is everybody. It's fairly clear if you really dive into it. Even Thomas Jefferson, who was the main author of those words with all his contradictions, right? Champion of natural rights, holder of slaves. I mean, the guy was kind of a mess, but if you read his notes as he was creating that, he intended it to mean all people, including African-American enslaved people. It got edited out in the process in committee before Congress approved it, but he was fairly clear on the ideals, even if he didn't follow them. But it's always that, right? Who counts? And then the question is, do people really, if they accept those ideals, how do they follow through on them? And the answer, just to, you know, we did stress tests, like real world situations that had just happened, you know, people declaring that, yes, they believe that we're in a covenant to uphold one another's ideals, 97-2. But if the question, you know, we framed a series of questions, members of your party have done X and X is a clear violation of those principles, you know, do you support that or not? If it was murky as to the, you know, partisan identity these days, everyone was like supporting the Declaration's ideals. But in situations where it was kind of clear from the context of today which party would be advantaged or disadvantaged, you saw a rapid falling off on the Republican side. But these were all situations where the Republicans were going to be disadvantaged. So what I'm saying is it's a work in progress. People did not inherently follow through on their theoretical commitment to the ideals. But that's the next phase in it, you know, what this really means in practice and being able to argue for the values, American ideals, part of any question put before people. You know, you have a political decision. One of them is clearly in alignment with the American experiment. One is clearly against. Being able to articulate that and tie the better choice to the Declaration, better choice because it comes from the Declaration, I think is a very powerful rhetorical tool to explain the stakes and why this is important and why you should care about this particular sub-issue.
We are talking about shared American ideals, shared American purpose. Is there one? If so, what is it? Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can get in an email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're discussing our shared values as Americans and whether we are able to tap into those to work together. My guest today, Ted Johnson, who is senior advisor at the organization New America and a Washington Post columnist, and Colin Woodard is director at the Nationhood Lab, which is based at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy. You can share your comments and questions with a brief email if you're quick, talk@mainepublic.org, or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Andrew, who's calling from Friendship. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi, I had a question about the Apportionment Act, because 100 years on, it's radically changed what would have been a different balance between the Senate and the House that, you know, originally was designed to be one was represented the small states equally and one represented the more populous states with more representation. And that balance is greatly out of whack. And I've been curious for a while why someone living in, say, California hasn't challenged that constitutionally at this point. That's my question. I'll hang up to let you talk.
Andrew, thanks. Colin, have you looked into that in relation to what we're talking about today?
I mean, there are a lot of things we can do to improve the way our elections and system work. And anytime you're able to better reflect the democratic feedback coming from the electorate, that's a good thing. So thus the interest in, you know, not having gerrymandered districts that are, you know, frustrating the signal the voters are getting you, giving you, rather than enhancing it. And the proportions, the fact that we have two senators from California and two senators from Wyoming, is obviously an enormous democratic deficit for the people of California relative to Wyoming. So all of those things, you know, if you could snap your fingers and we had a parliamentary system, the parliamentary systems have all kinds of problems too, but you don't have a situation where there's only two parties and you have to join one or the other, where you end up with these bizarre, unwieldy coalitions that, again, squelch the feedback you're getting from different interest groups. How can we have a party in this country? One party, you know, is representing libertarians and the Christian right together, and another party is representing, you know, labor unions and the bankers. I mean, it doesn't give you a lot of feedback because the coalitions are so huge, or not as effective feedback as you could. But how do you do that? You'd have to change the Constitution often. That's essentially impossible in our current depleted state of civics. But reforms that enhance that, be it ranked choice voting or other things, are to our benefit because they're making the system work better rather than confounding the sovereign, which is the people, and what they'd like to have happen.
Yeah, and I do think our caller was talking about the population. You know, California at 39.5 million people, with the same number of senators as Maine, with 1.3 million.
Right. Or Wyoming with 500,000. I mean, it's kind of bonkers.
Yeah, but, you know, so when the country was founded, folks in the Senate were elected by state assemblies. It wasn't even the people's popular vote of the state that elected the Senate. So at the founding, it was a small group of people who got to elect representatives at the state and federal level. And then those people did all the work for everything else, to elect the president, to elect the senators. And so it wasn't really a government of, by, and for the people. And a constitutional amendment changed it. So at least the senators would be elected popularly. You guys know what I'm trying to say. Okay, so here's the other part of this, though. I do believe it's important to maintain state distinctions when we make national decisions. And so I am not a fan of the Electoral College as it's currently constructed, but I am a fan of reforming it so that the proportional vote a candidate gets in any given state, they get that same proportion of electoral votes from that state instead of being a winner take all. And the reason for this is because while Rhode Island, Wyoming, you know, the Montana, Dakotas have very little people relative to California and Texas, New York, for example. Voters in Rhode Island are not voters in California. And so they're voting, their interests are different, their priorities are different. And if we give them the same amount of power in across elections, California always wins over the state of Rhode Island because of those interests. And so what the founders did, and I think it was smart, even if they didn't do it perfectly, was ensure that small states couldn't get run roughshod over by the large states. Now, I don't know if that means making the Senate the superior body in Congress and having that one be where everyone gets the same amount of votes was the right way. But I do believe in a system that maintains a state's distinct voice and not diluting that voice, whether they have lots of people or a few number of people. There are many ideas out there about, you know, reforms, either from state compacts to constitutional amendments. I'm a fan of lots of them because the current system is untenable for some of the reasons that the caller brought up and we've been hearing certainly around presidential elections for a couple of decades now.
We'll go to Richard calling from Biddeford. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I wonder if you all would address the idea that the founding mythology of this country is economic opportunity, you know, as evidenced by the investors who funded the initial settlements were looking to make a profit, and how that plays out today.
Colin's ready with this answer.
Yeah, I mean, there is the colonial period, right? We weren't the United States and weren't becoming the United States. And that set of ideals was not the founding ideal of the Puritans, New England, or the proprietary colony in North Carolina, or any of that. But once you get to the United States period, what the collective of the U.S. was supposed to be, that's where this becomes really relevant. And no, it wasn't economic opportunity. Where that myth comes from is from a specific region of the country. There's an area around New York City that was founded by the Dutch, and the greater New York City is still different from the rest of the country because it was essentially founded as a commercial, free market, global trading city. And it remains that. Amsterdam was the same thing. And the Dutch were a unique society in the 1600s of self-made people. You could go there and make it. All of their aristocrats of the early 1700s, you know, like the Schuylers, right, from Hamilton, were all started as nobodies, soldiers and, you know, day laborers. And you could all rise up. It was this dynamic society. All of your stories, your Horatio Alger stories of being able to arrive in land of opportunity and make it good, they all come out of New York City. Set in New York City, the Emma Lazarus poem that's on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty about bring us your huddled masses, it's New York City. It's an important weave, but it is not the story that started in the rest of the country. It's also can only exist as a subset of the Declaration's values, right? It's kind of the economic material subset of the pursuit of happiness and having an equal opportunity to go do that. If you don't have the Declaration's ideals, that economic piece of making it and having a fair shot isn't going to happen. There will be no fair shot if you're not intergenerationally trying to ensure that people have a meaningful shot at freedom and achieving their potential. So
it's interesting
to me it's a subset.
Well, and Ted, you recently wrote a column about the importance of the Statue of Liberty and its meaning in these times. And so I'm wondering about Richard's question in terms of thinking about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, you know, nations have symbols and sort of like their own rituals, their own sort of it's a way to practicing belonging. And so we've got our symbols, the flag and the eagle and the Statue of Liberty. But one of the non-tangible symbols we have, maybe one of the more powerful ones, is the American dream. And this is the focus of my next column, if I can ever figure it out. It's, you know, there's just like a competition between capitalism and democracy that happens. And as the caller said, our mythology is that we are a land of opportunity, which sort of implies prosperity for all who are willing to work hard. But it requires a democracy that allows all of us to participate for that dream to extend to us all. But I think we make a mistake when we make the American dream the pinnacle of what it means to belong here, because fundamentally the American dream is an economic proposition that if you work hard, and that if you, you know, with opportunity, you can prosper for you and your family, two and a half kids, two car garage, white picket fence, et cetera. That's the American dream. But it says nothing about voting. It says nothing about civic engagement. It says nothing about equality or sort of civic compassion or the things that it takes for a society to come together, especially a large, diverse society, to chase a set of ideals. So I'm a fan of the American dream, but I think we do ourselves a disservice when we make that the pinnacle of what it means to be American instead of the values and ideals that we've been talking about during the show.
Richard, thanks for your call. We'll go down to York and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer. I just want to make an observation. You were saying that everybody, or most people, believe in the Constitution, and yet they interpret it their own way. Under Trump, what he has done is he's turned people against people, immigrants, you know, get rid of this, get rid of that. And what I find now, even though people love the Constitution, they're using it in their own way, and there's so much hatred towards, say, Republicans particularly, they don't even call them Democrats, they call them liberals. I mean, hatred And I've never seen this in our country before. There was always, you know, talk across the aisle. But this hatred is, it's bizarre to me. And it's so real.
Margaret, thank you so much for bringing that up. So a couple points here, and I want to get to this sort of idea of hatred. But first, I think it's important to clarify, Colin, that your survey did not show people look to the Constitution to be the inspirational and defining document, but the Declaration. And that's important, right?
Yeah, the two are at odds. As I said, the Constitution is a flawed business plan to try to execute the mission of the Declaration. But we didn't test the Constitution's premises. It would be hard because it has so many internal contradictions. And the things we were talking about that complicate democracy, that are tripping us up, the Electoral College and, you know, how senators were elected in the past and representation, are all constitutional shortcomings, perhaps. So it's a practical document more than a set of ideals document. But the what the caller is getting at, I mean, anytime you have a liberal democracy starting to come apart and the ideals starting to fall away and the demagogues move in, that's exactly what demagogues do, right? It's about whatever the problems are. It's not the enemy is somebody external or some other, you know. It's the responsible, you know, the Martians did it, the purple people did it, whoever it is, there's always a target there, and you're to foment hate and violence against them. That's a playbook throughout history, and we're seeing the playbook again. So it's unfortunately par for the course for human homo sapiens and how they behave in groups. You don't want to go there. You want to avoid that and steer the car away from that situation.
Before we go to Ted, we're going to go to Fred in Bridgeton, who I believe has a related question.
Hi. Well, thanks for the program. And I have a simple question, which is there room for love in America, in any level of America?
Yeah, so Ted, Margaret was talking about, you know, how hate seems to be accepted and okay in America. And Fred's asking, is there room for love?
Yeah, so there's room. Whether there's like a capacity or an appetite for it, I think the answer is yes, but love is a lot of work. So here's what I'll say. One, whenever you believe, whether it's the Constitution, the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, whatever you believe, there are divisions in that belief system between people who interpret the written word, those rules, ideals, values one way, and those who take those same words and view them very differently. And so in this regard, as Colin said, we're just people debating ideas that have no gospel truth, no foundational, unrevocable truth. And so we're just trying to understand it for our times. Now, doing that can be a very tense and violent period of time, but it doesn't have to be. We've proven that we can fundamentally change the country without going to war. We proved it doing it with war, both at the Revolution and the Civil War. But the Civil Rights Movement, for all the political violence that was around, there were riots and political assassinations. But generally speaking, the nation did not have to descend into another all-encompassing war to extend the rights from the Declaration and from the amended Constitution to the people that had been excluded. That didn't require love, but it did require resolve. And we have to have resolve in order for the country to do better and sort of have these shared values together. But I don't know that it requires that we love one another in the biblical sense or even in a more social sense where we're, you know, sacrificing for others to the point of giving your life is expected just for belonging.
We're in this together is enough to hold it together and the sort of commitment that we need.
Linked faiths, that's right.
And there's, you know, I should say that there's also polling, not just ours, but all over the place. There really is 20-25% of people who are all in for authoritarianism and ethno-nationalism. I mean, that not everybody is going to be swayed because some people truly don't want that. And that's a feature of societies everywhere.
Nice.
So that, you know, be aware that that exists. And a lot of the numbers and the narrative that I've been describing, the sort of one-pager, you listeners can find at nationhoodlab.org, which is our website. You can dig into the data and the crosstabs. You can read the narrative. We also want to know, do you need to create slightly different customized versions for different regions or different demographic segments? And the answer was basically no, but there is a conservative audience only variant with a few changes that are annotated that you can see that just works better with conservatives, but not as well with everybody else. So you can dig into all those details there. But yes, there are people who really do like demagogues, and you're not going to change their mind because they really don't agree with the American experiment. And they've always been with us in all other countries.
Well, as you said, it was about 70-30, right? So, Fred, thank you for your question, the last question of the hour. And thank you to our guest, Colin Woodard, an author, journalist, and director of the Nationhood Lab, and Theodore Johnson, Ted Johnson, a senior advisor at New America. He's on the board of the Nationhood Lab, and he's a columnist at The Washington Post. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a tie-in with our TV show Borealis. We're going to learn about all the animal rehab organizations in the state. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.